Chapter 4. Here Comes the Boys' Brigade. A few weeks after we had returned, sunburnt and happy, from one of the Shoreham holidays, we left the old house where I had spent all the 11 years of my life, and moved to a semi-detached council house on the Streatham side of Tooting. The removal took place in early autumn. What afterwards became Father's garden, complete with lawn, flower beds and vegetable plot, was then a wilderness. Large yellow-green leaves from the old fig tree behind the house carpeted the ground. Weeds grew shoulder-high. Halfway down the garden, which was no more than 100 feet long, stood a line of ragged blackcurrant bushes, round which Joan and I were soon playing cowboys and Indians. At the far end, underneath the back fence, was a rhubarb bed. Along the fence on the left grew loganberries which had not been pruned for years. But best of all I remember the chrysanthemums, which grew red and yellow and bronze all over the garden. So many of them were there that all the autumn the air was filled with their acrid scent. Indeed, whether because I had never seen chrysanthemums growing in such profusion before, or because there is a subtle relation between scents and moods, or because they symbolised something I felt but could not express, those frost-bitten blossoms growing so rankly in the neglected garden were one of the major emotional experiences of my life. One afternoon, not long after our removal, Joan and I heard Mother excitedly calling out to us from the front gate. A strange red glare overspread the whole southeastern horizon and was reflected above the housetops far into the sky, where it shaded off into an angry pink. Every now and then a flame would leap up or a wisp of smoke drift black across the crimson. As we watched the glow, which certainly came from no common house fire, icy fingers of fear for a moment touched our hearts. That evening we learned that the Crystal Palace had been burned to the ground. The following spring I wrote my first poems. The actual writing of them I do not remember, but I quite clearly recall handing a certain red notebook over the fence to the plump pigtail girl next door, whom I had told about the poems. With this girl, as well as with her elder sister and younger brother, I had become friends during the winter. My parents had become acquainted with hers. Nora's mother, a Somerset woman, was a paragon of respectability. On Sabbath mornings, sedate in her Sunday best, she could be seen sallying forth to the Methodist Central Hall, which she also attended during the week, being very prominent at prayer meetings and flower shows. Nora and Peter usually accompanied her. At home, the children were allowed to play only hymns on the piano. They were frequently scolded, and Joan and I often heard the whack of a cane followed by a shriek from the other side of the fence. Nora's father, who was in the police force, fared no better. A hulking, red-faced fellow, he was always being driven out of the house with a broomstick by his plump, pious wife, whose terms of endearment as she thwacked him were clearly audible. After she had withdrawn, slamming the back door behind her, he would go and sit beside the chained watchdog, who, also being regularly beaten, would wag its tail in silent sympathy. In this domestic warfare the children took sides, Nora and Peter supporting their mother, and Phyllis, the eldest, their father. Even at that time, Phyllis bitterly hated her mother, and as she grew older, did her best to defend the pusillanimous policeman from the onslaughts of Methodism militant, sometimes carrying the war into the enemy's camp. With all three children, Joan and I were on friendly terms, unless it happened that Nora, who was the nearest to me in age, came to be reading my poems that spring. What I was reading at this time I do not know. Perhaps most of my time was devoted to painting. Certainly it was in the course of the same year that my parents, for the first and last time, discussed the advisability of sending me to an art school. The 17-year-old daughter of one of Mother's friends studied at the Slade School of Fine Art, and one day she sent me, through Mother, a portfolio of life drawings. They were all male and female nudes, complete with carefully drawn genitals. Mother and father seemed to have decided that such studies might not be good for my morals, for though I drew and painted as industriously as ever, there was no more talk of sending me to an art school. That Christmas I met with a book that swung me, almost violently, from art to literature. Among the presents at my bedside on Christmas morning was a blue-bound copy of Paradise Lost, the title of which had stood high on my latest book list. That morning I had the greatest poetic experience of my life. If it was the reading of Spencer that made a poet of Keats, it was that apocalypse of Miltonic sublimity that made of me, from that day onwards, if not a poet yet, at least a modest practitioner of the art of verse. Thereafter I knew no rest until I had planned an epic of my own. What the subject matter was I do not know, but I remember that it was in blank verse, divided stanza-like into blocks of 9 lines each, and opened with the appearance of a very Miltonic angel in my bedroom. Other poets whom I read, admired, and imitated included Keats, Mrs. Browning, and Houseman. The first I read in a little pink leather and gilt volume of selections, enjoying most of all the sonnets and the descriptions of Circe from Endymion and the deposed Saturn from Hyperion. Mrs. Browning's A Drama of Exile and The Lay of the Brown Rosary I admired inordinately, chanting the latter aloud in my delight to the four walls of my bedroom. Many of the lyrics of A Shropshire Lad also made a strong appeal to me, especially the one beginning, "Loveliest of trees, the cherry now is hung with bloom along the bough," which seemed almost the last word in consummate beauty of expression. Rossetti's poems I knew at that time only by the quotations in William Sharp's Study of the Poet, but meagre as these were, the intensely fused sensuousness and mysticism of which they breathed went to my head like some subtle and dangerous perfume. For many years, Milton and Rossetti were my favourite poets. Hard on the heels of my epic, of which I wrote only 900 lines, came a medieval drama with chantus, perhaps borrowed from Thomas Hardy, and a whole succession of lyrics. Nor was prose neglected. The same period saw the beginning of a history of the reign of Queen Elizabeth, of which I wrote 20 or 30 foolscap pages. A short story about ancient Egypt in the style of Joan Grant's Winged Pharaoh, and The Life of Siddhartha Gautama the Buddha, which, when finished, I copied out in purple ink on my best notepaper. Meanwhile at school, which I continued to attend, though having a much longer walk each day than before, the curriculum had been disrupted by several events of interest. The first of these had transformed me into a pirate. Included in the senior department's Christmas entertainment was the staging of Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance, the rehearsals for which kept us busy for several months. Though I had played Sir Walter Raleigh in an Empire Day playlet while in the juniors, as well as acting the part of Shylock, in which I had drawn much applause by the way I sharpened my knife on the sole of my foot as I declared, "I will have my pound of flesh." This was the first time I had ever been a pirate. Mother and father feared the excitement might upset my heart, especially as in one scene the chorus of pirates had to dance a few steps, kicking their legs up into the air as they did so. Moreover, on the day of the performance, which was attended by parents, I did not get to bed till 1 o'clock. However, I was none the worse for the experiment with piracy. Another disruption was caused by the Golden Jubilee celebrations of the LCC, in which all London schools naturally participated. Our contribution was a topography of southwest London, a subject in which Smokey Joe had done a considerable amount of research. The topography was written page by page on the blackboard, from which it was painfully copied by all the children in the class, Smoky Joe having told us that the neatest copy would be sent to the Jubilee exhibition at County Hall. Among other topographical facts, I learnt that Tooting was named after one Tut, an Anglo-Saxon chief who had sailed up the River Wandle, hence Wandsworth, the name of our borough, and founded a settlement. That Tooting Beck was so called from the Abbey of Beck in Normandy, to which lands there had been gifted shortly after the conquest. That Nelson had been born at Merton, and that Daniel Defoe had worshipped in a dissenting chapel at Clapham. When, later on, we were taken to the exhibition, I saw my copy of the topography, finely bound, occupying the place of honour in the middle of the hall. The last of the disruptive events is hardly on the same scale as its predecessors, though it had consequences which were for me not unimportant. For this one, Smoky Joe was in a way responsible. While he corrected the exercise books on Friday afternoons, it was my task to speak to the class. One day I spoke on my curios, which by that time included a blue silk Chinese robe embroidered with carp and lotuses, a pair of ivory chopsticks complete with knife and silver toothpicks in a silver-mounted ivory case, bamboo nose ornaments from Borneo, a thunderbolt, pieces of gum tree, all gifts from Nana, a Chinese monkey with a bag on his back, a little old woman carrying loads, a teak bat carved with peacocks, two halberds from the Tower of London, two Chinese executioner's swords in green leather scabbards, a 16th century Dutch tile depicting Jacob's ladder, a Moroccan dagger, a Sung Dynasty bowl, precious and semi-precious stones, all these from father, an Indian wire bracelet, a rosary and sundry foreign coins from other sources. There was also a small brass incense burner in the shape of the famous Kamakura Buddha, bought at a Brighton curio shop with my own money, in which I regularly burned sticks of very sweet incense, my first act of Buddhist worship. Smoky Joe asked me to turn the substance of my talk into an essay, and it was this essay which, on its being shown to a visiting inspector, led to my being transferred to a better school. The institution in which I now found myself was, of course, better than my old school in the opinion of my parents and teachers, in fact of the world generally, but not necessarily in mine. The real source of my education was still the Tooting Public Library. But I donned without protest the uniform of the new school, green cap and blazer with grey flannel trousers, and every day made the slightly longer journey to and from its more exclusive precincts. On the day of my admission, the headmaster sent me to join my class, where a history lesson was in progress. All the double desks were full except two, one of which contained a very blonde girl with roses and cream complexion and china blue eyes, while in the other sat a swarthy girl with black hair and brown eyes. These, as I afterwards found, were the beauties of the class and inseparable friends. Seeing my hesitation, the master called out good-humouredly, "Take your choice. Which of these two young ladies would you prefer to sit beside?" There was a general titter from the class. The fair one blushed, and the dark one smiled. "If they sit together, I can have a desk to myself," I replied. This arrangement was quite satisfactory to the two beauties, who had, before my entrance, been separated for talking during the lesson, and I accordingly took my seat at the desk, which the fair one promptly vacated. Despite the fact of my being 2 years behind in the course, the headmaster had decided that I should join a class higher than that to which my age entitled me. In the subjects which interested me most, history, English and art, I at once went to the top. In mathematics, which I hated, I stayed somewhere near the bottom. Physics, French, shorthand, typing and bookkeeping were all new to me, but I soon caught up with my classmates. Chemistry, also a new subject, I disliked, but the crusty old chemistry master, a great rapper on knuckles with the ruler, fortunately, was much more of a stickler for copperplate handwriting and neatness in the illustration of experiments than he was for knowledge of chemistry, and always gave me good marks. Being still excused games, I spent the games period in the art room. The art master, a small, grey-headed man in sweater and sandals, who flirted with the girl students and swore at the boys, was not just an ordinary teacher who took art, but a real artist, the first I ever met. "Bloody Christ," he would mutter whenever a student submitted a drawing. "What do you call this?" With him I soon became well acquainted, sometimes contriving with his contrivance to be sketching in the art room when I should have been doing geometry elsewhere. He was good enough to correct my drawings, showing me exactly how to make an eye gleam or a petal look soft, things which even Smoky Joe had not taught me. Even more interesting was a teacher who joined the staff after I had started attending the school and left before we were evacuated. He was a short, well-built, youngish man with flaming red hair, red moustache and red beard. Apparently he had only three interests or enthusiasms in life: George Bernard Shaw, atheism and chess. Thanks to him we read, that is to say listened to, perhaps a dozen of GBS's plays. During the history period he read Caesar and Cleopatra or St. Joan. During geography, The Devil's Disciple, presumably because its action takes place in the wide open spaces of America. And the rest of Shaw's works during English lessons and on Friday afternoons. In my case, this unorthodox method of instruction proved entirely successful. Though I have long since forgotten everything else I learnt that year, the memory of these marathon reading sessions, when on hot summer afternoons we had only to sit and listen while he read steadily through the two stout volumes of the collected plays, is still fresh and vivid. Atheism was generally inculcated during the morning scripture lessons, which, being nominally a member of the Church of England, he was obliged to take. Chess came in the afternoon during our last period, and usually continued long after the rest of the school had gone home to tea. Playing 20 or 30 boys simultaneously, moving in a matter of seconds from one board to the next, he invariably defeated us all. Alas, after a few months he was transferred to another school, whether because of the scripture lessons or because his appointment had only been a temporary one, we never knew. With my fellow students I had very little personal contact, except for my best friend Clement, who was only 6 months older than I was. All the other boys in the class were senior to me by 2 years, and the meaningless obscenity of their conversation disgusted me. Besides, shortly after our removal to the new house, I had joined the Boys' Brigade, and for the next 4 years, membership of this organisation fully satisfied my gregarious instincts. At 6 o'clock one cold November evening, when it had already been dark for more than an hour, Mother and I found ourselves looking, from the opposite side of the road, at the as-yet-unlit hall in which brigade meetings were held. Seeing our hesitation, a 16-year-old sergeant, in the blue and white brigade uniform, detached himself from the group of boys talking at the gate, and coming over to us, asked if he could be of any assistance. Before many weeks had passed, I was as keen a member as any in the company. Meetings were held several times a week, and I was never absent. On Fridays there were the weekly parades, for which brasses had to be cleaned, leather polished, and piping whitened. After the inspection we were drilled, going through such simple manoeuvres as marching up and down the hall, turning about, halting, and forming fours. All meetings opened and closed with prayer. The officers who drilled us consisted of the captain of the company, a lieutenant, and two staff officers. The captain, whom the regular members called Skipper, was a short, flaxen-haired, brisk little man who worked for a well-known shipping line, on whose behalf he occasionally attended shipping conferences in Rome, Amsterdam, and other places. Besides being our captain, he was superintendent of the Sunday school, and held various offices in the Baptist church to which we were attached. The lieutenant, known to us as Reg, and the two young staff officers, brothers who had been christened Roland and Oliver, were all teachers in the Sunday school, Reg being in addition a sidesman of the church. In due course I started attending not only the parades, but also the Sunday morning Bible class, the Wednesday evening prayer meeting, the Thursday evening Morse and Semaphore class, and the Monday evening band practice, at which I thumped a side drum. The company was a small one, never more than 60 strong. Like similar groups the world over, it had a hard core of enthusiasts who could be relied upon to turn up for all meetings with the regularity of clockwork. One of the reasons for which I became one of the band of 15 or 20 stalwarts, whose unflagging devotion it was that, next to the zeal of the captain and officers, kept the company going, was that it satisfied my natural human craving to belong to a group. Another was that the strongly ethical tone of the BB, as we affectionately referred to our organisation, with its emphasis on clean living, team spirit, sense of responsibility, service, and fear of God, struck chords in my heart which even poetry and painting were powerless to vibrate. This was all the more the case, inasmuch as I saw the qualities of which the BB thought so highly, exemplified not only in Skipper and the officers, but also, to a lesser degree, in many of the boys. For the latter, therefore, I had a far stronger feeling of brotherhood than for my foul-mouthed associates at school. But the strongest reason for the almost fanatical punctiliousness with which I discharged the obligations of membership was the one of which I was then least aware. Among the members was a friendly, affable, good-looking boy about 2 years senior to me, and for him I at once developed an ardent affection. This early love, to which I remained faithful throughout the whole of my BB career, as well as for some time afterwards, was one of those dumb adolescent attachments which nobody seems to notice, least of all its object. If on raw winter evenings, when more often than not it was raining or even snowing, I hastened through the dimly lit streets with eagerly beating heart, it was not only because of the thought of the cheery voices that would greet me as I entered the brightly lit hall, but with the hope of seeing, and fear of not seeing, that dearest of all faces. Since Sid was as faithful a member as I was, I rarely had to suffer the pangs of disappointment. But though we met several times a week, and were on the best of terms, we never became close friends. Strangely enough, this was a deprivation which I never felt. Being utterly happy merely to see his face and hear his voice, it never occurred to me to desire a more intimate relationship. In accordance with the constitution of the movement, which had been founded as a means of encouraging young men and boys to lead Christian lives, every company of the BB was attached to a church, the priest or minister in charge of which became the honorary colonel. The Baptist church to which our company belonged was a fairly new red brick building, complete with steeple, which stood facing Mitcham Lane, about half a mile from the top of the road down which I lived. On the opposite corner, also facing Mitcham Lane, stood the Anglican parish church. The congregation which filled the red brick building on Sunday mornings and evenings consisted mainly of prosperous artisans, small shopkeepers, white-collar workers, and other representatives of the petty bourgeoisie from Lower Streatham. During the years in which I was a member of the BB, it had, as its pastor, a man of deep and fervent piety and great preaching ability. Thanks to his ministrations, as well as to the labours of the more devoted of the laity, the congregation grew steadily and the church flourished. The close connection which existed between the BB and the churches to which the companies were affiliated encouraged, and indeed was intended to encourage, a more active participation on the part of its members in organised religious life. In my case, the progression from the church hall, in which Friday evening parades were held, to the church itself occurred quite naturally. Our Sunday morning Bible class began at 10 o'clock and lasted an hour. We sang hymns of the more virile type, such as Onward, Christian Soldiers, sat with bowed heads through extempore prayers, and listened to a talk of the jocular, muscular variety by Skipper. When these proceedings were over, I strolled into church with the other boys as a matter of course, taking my place with them in the gallery, where I sat near Sid. Below us at the far end of the church was a huge pulpit, the size of a small room, from which the pastor not only preached, but conducted the service. On either side of this structure were the choir stalls. In front of it was the Lord's table, whereon always stood a vase of flowers. Behind it, the organ. From the back rows of the gallery, where the BB usually sat, only the first two rows of the downstairs pews were visible. Though we sometimes yawned and fidgeted during the long sermon, the BB boys always conducted themselves with proper reverence. In the gallery I met Mr. Young, the elderly stonemason in a very stiff white collar, who was sidesman for that part of the church. As he gave each of us in turn a handshake and a hymn book, his deeply lined face lit up with a warm smile. He and Skipper, who was a member of the choir, were both firm believers in the necessity of making a joyful noise before the Lord, and during the singing of the hymns, their two voices, raised as in competition, would be heard high above the lusty voices of the rest of the congregation. Mr. Young always prolonged the concluding note of each verse much longer than anyone else, frequently ending with a screech that was apt to be rather disconcerting to the newcomer. He it was, I believe, who invited me to attend the Sunday school, where I joined his class, of which Sid and a few other boys were already members. For some reason or other, he took the keenest interest in my spiritual welfare, and with great conviction told the rest of the class that the Lord had chosen me out for a great work. Being, as he was, a Bible Christian of the fundamentalist type, his interest took the form of strong encouragement in the prayerful study of the Word of God. Each quarter he gave me a little book of daily Bible readings, of which I regrettably made less use than he had hoped. Occasionally he called on me at home, where he met father and mother, who respected him very much for his rugged, almost gnarled and knotted, piety. After my evacuation, he sent me the Bible readings by post. Another member of the church, who, though for a shorter period, wrought for me in the Lord, was a plump, almost burly youth of 18 or 19, with crinkly hair and a suave, soft manner, called Ben. His attack on the problem of salvation was not quite so frontal as that of my older preceptor. Having started a boys' club, where we played table tennis on Wednesday evenings, he invited two or three of the more promising members at the time to his house for tea. After a substantial repast, over which his mother presided, we found ourselves, one by one, on our knees in the drawing-room, with Ben also on his knees, loudly praying beside us. When his prayer, in which he offered up our sinful souls to Jesus, was over, we had to offer them up on our own behalf. In this workmanlike manner he converted a number of boys, for having eaten his excellent tea, we felt it would not be good manners to refuse to be saved. Besides Sunday school and the club, I attended for a time the prayer meeting for young men, which was held weekly in the vestry. This was the sort of evangelical equivalent of a confirmation class, though here less emphasis was placed on doctrine than on devotion, and it was hoped that some, at least, of those who attended would become active church members. One of the main functions of these meetings was to encourage us in the practice of extempore prayer, to which the Baptists, like most dissenting churches, attached great importance. Kneeling on the ground before our chairs, on the seats of which we rested our elbows. We prayed aloud in turn in such words as we were able to muster. Most of the boys, if not all, borrowed the pious phraseology of their elders, and with a little practice were able to offer up prayers with the same unfeeling facility with which they wrote essays at school. Hymns were sung to the accompaniment of a rather ancient piano harmonium, which Sid was always glad of an opportunity to play, and there was a Bible reading. Either Reg or Mr. Young usually spoke, but once we studied Bunyan's Holy War for several weeks in succession, with a speaker from another church. On one occasion, our own pastor addressed us on the imminence of the Second Coming and Last Judgment, speaking with such eloquent earnestness that I could not help glancing out of the open window at the peaceful summer evening sky, half expecting to see there angels descending in the van of the Lord. Yet, despite membership of the BB, regular attendance at church and Sunday school, and frequent prayer meetings, the development of my religious convictions was not really influenced at all. This was due partly to the very nature of Baptist Christianity itself, which made not reason but the emotions its chief target, and partly to the fact that I had started thinking for myself in matters of religion. Only once did I have a serious argument. This occurred at one of the vestry prayer meetings, when a boy of my own age maintained that salvation was by faith alone, and I declared it was by faith and works. Usually I was satisfied with a temporary emotional exaltation, returning home after a particularly moving sermon with my heart on fire with devotion to the person of Christ. But at night, when I said my prayers, I still said them, as my habit was at that period, to the Buddha, Christ and Muhammad in turn, it being my naive conviction that by this means I should be sure of gaining the ear of whoever happened to be the true Saviour.